Today's guest is Kate Birch from Minnesota, who has been practicing homeopathy since 1994 and is an internationally respected book author and teacher. She is also the international director of Free and Healthy Children International, a nonprofit organization. Kate specializes in infectious disease and epidemiology as it relates to the practice of homeopathy. She is part of a community of over 80 homeopathic practitioners around the world who have taken the historical application of homeopathy and infectious disease prevention towards a new paradigm of public health for the families they serve. They've also completed 10 years of research on homeoprophylaxis in children and spent 2020 to 2022 researching and overseeing the clinical application of the homeopathic immunization to COVID. As the International Director of Free and Healthy Children International, Kate stays up to date on infectious disease trends, homeopathic prevention and treatment options, and immune system health. The communication channels that the organization has established with its practitioners and membership allows for rapid communications and clinical applications for all interventions developed and propagated. You can learn more about Kate or book an appointment at www.hiphealth.com. That's HIPPhealth.com. If you'd like to learn more about Free and Healthy Children International, visit www.freeandhealthychildren.org. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we get to hang out with Kate Birch in Minnesota. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's lovely to have you on. I've had so many guests reach out to me to get you on the show, and your name has been on my radar for a long time, so it's very nice to have you on.
Good, yes.
Now, we're going to dive into some really interesting topics today, but before we do, I always ask my guests to let us know how they were first introduced to homeopathy.
So it was back in the early 90s, late 89. And I had moved to California and I had a baby and with his father, and we had a friend who's also a homeopath. He's since deceased. His name is Eric Summerman. And he was a friend of the family and he saw how dysfunctional we were. And he's like, you guys need to go see a homeopath. And, you know, there was a lot going on. My health was challenged with a new baby. My partner was drinking too much. Baby was crying all the time. And after a few remedies in a few months, it's like we were completely different people. And that's where it began. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. And so you went to train shortly after that?
Well, I was 21 at the time. But as soon as I started school, it was with a direction to become a homeopath. So at that time, there was only one school in the United States, and that was the Hahnemann College out of Berkeley. And you had to be an MD to go there. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go through medical school and, you know, prepare myself. And then I was in college anyways, which was useful because I took all my sciences and stuff like that. But by the time I was just like, I don't care. I'm not going to medical school, because I began to see, you know, the Organon was the first book in homeopathy I read. And I read the Organon, you know, that was how I got my teeth into it. And I realized that like my whole life, I have lived as a homeopath from those readings that I had. And I said, you know, all of the teachers at that school that require you to be an MD, they just started learning themselves. And so I started, but then I did find another school opened, the Pacific Academy of Homeopathy. And that was in the Bay Area also. And so I started there.
Oh, that's so cool. I think you must know Kelly Callahan. I think she's from your area as well, isn't she? I think she's from, no, that's a different area. No, I'm thinking Kathleen Shibley is from Bay Area.
Yes. I kind of reconnected. Like I moved out of California 23 years ago or more than that, because I lived in Colorado a few years. But then I reconnected back with the community after, well, the formation of Free and Healthy Children International, when I started lecturing more. And so I was invited to speak up there.
Amazing. And now one of the main topics we're going to be talking about today is homeoprophylaxis, or some people know it as homeopathic immunization, not homeopathic vaccination, which it incorrectly is called sometimes, just to clarify that right from the start. Now, what was your interest in homeopathic immunization or homeoprophylaxis? Because I know in my studies,
we were never really taught much about it. And we were taught that it was kind of frowned upon. And it wasn't until after I finished my studies that I went to go read Dr. Isaac Golden's books. And I realized the benefits of homeopathic immunization, that I then did that with my children later on. But how did you get introduced to homeopathic immunization, homeoprophylaxis?
Well, this is a long story, but it does go back to the beginning. You know, part of why we needed homeopathy, my son was crying all the time and he had night terrors, and I had given him a DPT vaccine when he was 2 months old, just like you're to do. And he started screaming and I was like, I really don't like that. Like, what was that? I didn't like it before it happened. I didn't like it after it happened, but I'm a young mom and like, you know, holding him and like, what's going on? And so that was always sort of on my mind. And by the time I went to homeopathy school, I was pregnant with my daughter, and that was 7 years later. So I did college and that. And I said, okay, I'm learning all these homeopathy for infectious disease. And so I'm not going to vaccinate her. And I didn't vaccinate her. And really, it was on my mind. And I started watching, certainly in the 90s, I started seeing more cases of children with ear infections and hyperactivity and ADD. These were the diagnoses then in the 90s. And I began to see, okay, well, these are vaccines. You know, I could see that it was the vaccines causing insults again in the immune system. And come, you know, 1999, I was thinking, okay, this is going to break. Pretty soon, this is going to break. Or maybe it was 2000. Like, people are really going to wake up and see that these vaccines aren't doing things. And there was Andy Wakefield was already presenting his stuff on measles. And there was, you know, there's following what the people were saying. And even nobody really knows this, but Andy Wakefield, there was a senator who had done a congressional hearing and called Andy Wakefield in, and they listened to him as he said, you need to study the MMR vaccine and see if it's causing autism. And based on his testimony, the FDA and the CDC, they did do study on MMR vaccine. They started that study in 2021 or 2001. It was supposed to be published that year. It wasn't published until 2004. And if you saw the movie Vaxxed, basically that we didn't really know what happened, but those 3 years when it wasn't published was they were hiding all the data because it does cause autism. And meanwhile, the only thing that happened was Andy Wakefield got completely, you know, Wakefielded off of the scene. And so I had been watching all this and seeing more and more, like my first autistic cases were in 2000, and just becoming pretty perturbed by the effects of vaccines. And so I started doing public talks on vaccination. And then, of course, I wrote Vaccine Free. That's the first book that I wrote, Treatment and Prevention of Infectious Disease with Homeopathy. And because I'm like, okay, I can tell my parents, oh, yeah, homeopathy can help this. But they're looking like, what information? Because there's the censorship is, you know, erased homeopathy from anybody's minds. And so that's why I wrote that book. But that book took me to Cuba, where I met Isaac Golden. I had not heard of homeoprophylaxis, but I was invited. A colleague that I met, and she's, you know, had been speaking and presenting already in Cuba, and she got me invited to speak at this conference. And there I met Golden, and I also was introduced to many other people doing homeoprophylaxis and what the Cuban government had been doing.
Oh, that's really cool. So that was actually your introduction to the homeoprophylaxis. Funny.
Yeah, I didn't go there looking for that. Certainly, I went to thinking back, like my paper was called The Role of Government in the Management of Infectious Disease. And retrospectively, I thought, boy, what an upstart, you know, for me to come to Cuba and tell them the role of government in infectious disease management. Yeah. But I was blown away by what they did there. I was blown away. And so this was 2008, and they had done their leptospirosis study. First dosing was in 2007. Second dosing was in 2008. And so they had the results, and the conference was immediately after. and, you know, what the numbers were. But more than that, they talked about hepatitis A in schools. They talked about viral conjunctivitis that was epidemic at certain points. They talked about, well, they didn't talk about AIDS, but I knew that the history of Cuba using homeopathy for AIDS and doing quite well with that, and a bunch of other different diseases. But then some of the other presenters there, there were some from Africa and working homeoprophylaxis with animals and cows. And more importantly, what got me during that conference was the Minister of Health and the things that he said. And what I saw, so the way that that government is set up is that the thesis in my paper was that infectious disease comes when there's a susceptibility in an individual. And it comes collectively when there's a susceptibility in that collective. Like, why cholera came to Europe at the time when it did, you know, what was going on there in the social, economic, political background that, and the public health background, like why cholera became so at that time, you know, there's so many tracks I can go on. I happened to read A History of Paris for my daughter in eighth grade, which was at the same time I was writing the cholera chapter. And it was the same time that, you know, Hahnemann lived there and was treating the cholera epidemics. And then I'm learning about how they're guillotining people, like the Reign of Terror after the fall of the monarchy. 40,000 people were killed in the town square. You can understand now why people went into a camphora state, because they were in such absolute shock from seeing that many people dead. And it's like death all around in the world. It's like, you know, and all the rich people lost all their money. And so Veratrum is there and Napoleon came along to save the day. And so Cuprum is there. And it's just like, it gave me, so writing the book already gave me an idea. It's like infectious disease doesn't happen in a vacuum, or does. I mean, it doesn't happen just randomly by itself. And so then if you look at an epidemic, and so certainly this has laid the path to, you know, all the work that I've done leading up until the coronavirus research, right? But the role of government, what I presented was that in benevolence, the government is to purvey the people and understand the political social strife that they're in, and look also at the public health needs of those people. Like, certainly the sewer out of the water is like the first thing, right? And that's going to, of course, bring cholera down. I mean, they just dump chamber pots out the window. So, you know, in Paris at the time when this is like, so you've got to clean that up. So with that in mind, you know, when I was there, I was wondering what leptospirosis was about, why that it was so problematic on the island. And I don't have the answer, but I learned a lot. And what I learned was, so the Finlay Institute, who did that research, they're a WHO vaccine license manufacturer, and they made vaccines for Central America, Mexico, South America, and a lot for Africa too, because part of Castro's work was going to Africa and creating alliances with countries there. And so a part of that Finlay Institute, so the Finlay Institute sponsored the conference, and they are the ones that made the leptospirosis nozode. And they made that.
That in itself is actually pretty amazing. I don't know if people really understand that. Like, this is a WHO certified vaccine manufacturing.
They made it. And let me tell you what happened in that conference.
From leptospirosis. And then this conference that invited homeopaths over.
Yes. So yeah, let me tell you what happened, because this is like leads into a whole pathway. So they of course had these other, like they had hepatitis A in the schools, and they gave phosphorus to so many schools. And one of the persons said, well, we wanted to study it more, but within a few weeks, there was no more hepatitis, you know. And then they also have problems, like they didn't have enough money to feed the rats for the experiments, you know, the pre-experiments and stuff like that. But with the leptospirosis, what I saw was, going back to the minister, he says, you know, Cuba is free. Like, part of the embargo made it so they needed to become self-reliant. And he said, we are free. And, you know, homeoprophylaxis is for the people. And we're going to do it like this. And in 2 weeks' time, at like a 10% of the cost of what it would cost to vaccinate everybody with leptospirosis vaccine, they gave the Nozode, and it took 2 weeks to prepare it and deliver it to the little villages, and then, or to the towns, and then the people would come in with their cups of sugar and they would anoint the sugar and then take it back to their villages. And within that amount of time, they got 2.5 million doses out, right? So the last day of the conference, there's also, so Gustavo Bracco was the main person. There's also Dr. Concepcion Campa, and she's a beautiful woman. She was in her 70s, 80s. I mean, just still eloquent, intelligent, works for Finlay Institute. And we had a two-hour sort of powwow at the end of the conference. And the plan was that the Finlay Institute was going to create a whole list of nozodes that would be available, and they were going to do research on that. So that was 2008. So, you know, Obama was elected, I believe it was 2006. And after that conference, and certainly, you know, news got out, and then the quack busters got on our trail and started bashing it. And Gustavo Bracco, who had, they also had meningitis. That was the first nozode that they ever did. But he had written articles for every kind of medical journal that took his papers on the vaccines. But as soon as it came to homeoprophylaxis, it was banned. And, you know, part of my story is when I came back, I was so impressed at the role of government. You know, they did exactly the model that I was thinking should be happening for. And so I put a package together for Obama, which included my vaccine-free book, included the paper, the leptospirosis paper, and included my paper, The Role of Government, and This is What Government Should Be Doing for Us in a Public Health Way. I really didn't understand, and I still, like, there's layers and layers and layers of it that are being peeled back from the 100-year agenda that got us to the place of COVID. And all in the vaccine paradigm, and just being on the other side of it with homeoprophylaxis and knowing our remedies, but more importantly, going into the coronavirus research and the proving of coronavirus and the after effects, like the remedies actually told us what was happening. And I can say more about that, but there's, you know, a 10-year gap in between Cuba and now. So if you have questions, or, you know, where I can go to a few different places.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, that's actually the part that I was really intrigued in, is finding out about the proving of the nozode and your thoughts on COVID. But that was really interesting, hearing about your experience. And actually, what happened with that package that you put together for Obama? I'm guessing nothing.
No, a few things might have happened.
Except like a letter to say that they at least received.
I did. I got a letter from, it says, thank you for contributing to, because at that point they were trying to push through the, you know, healthcare for all or whatever. Thank you for your contributions to healthcare reform was a letter. But I'll tell you something else about that package. I also included a nozode kit. And, you know, in America, they've had, you know, anthrax was in the mail, and, you know, there's different things that are contaminated at some point, whatever. I put in a homeoprophylaxis kit with a big red sign saying, caution, contains infectious agents. And just like I wanted to flag it, I wanted to, you know, I could just imagine the people unpacking the mail, right? What's in this box? But within that time, the embargo was being lifted in Cuba, and all the news about, oh, we're going to bring the prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, they were going to go to Wisconsin somewhere. But you know what? They couldn't, because the way that they were treating the prisoners was, there's no American law that could support that, right? So they had to keep them in there. But more than that, Gustavo Bracco started getting death threats, and he needed to leave the country. And I don't know the entire story of that, but part of their lifting the embargo was taking their agenda down there. And so all of those plans that we talked about with the nozodes completely shut down. That separated, you know, they had the Ministry of Science, the Ministry of Research, all these things. The homeopathy and homeoprophylaxis was included in all that. And so there's all these divisions, and they were going to do another conference like 2 years from that one. And that was stopped. And I haven't been back to Cuba. I don't know what it's like there, but I don't know if the letter that I sent flagged that or if that's part of the agenda anyways, because clearly the work of Obama in his life or what he was forced to do, I don't know how much volition he had in it, was the vaccine agenda that got us to where we are now. Because even when Vax came, that was like 2016, I was finally, somebody's talking about this. Like, I've been racking my brain, you know, seeing more and more vaccine damaged kids. And then also I brought homeoprophylaxis back. I met Isaac Golden and I'm so grateful for meeting him. And I asked, well, I can't start providing homeoprophylaxis in America unless I do research, because it, even though he did wonderful research in Australia, there's no ground to stand on in the United States. So I asked him, could I use your, you know, questionnaires? And I basically copied this construct of his research. And then I wrote the book, The Solution, and with Scylla Wadcott. And then in the writing, we're like, well, we can't just write a book about this. We need to train practitioners. We need to make an organization. And we did it. The organization is Free and Healthy Children International. So the research had already started, but then we had this 501c3. And what that did is it created an infrastructure that was able to provide a public health campaign, you know, a public health model from an organized place instead of, you know, each homeopath doing their own thing, which they love to do. But when it comes to public health, and when it comes to managing people, and particularly people who don't know about homeopathy, like what to do, we want to make it the same. We want to speak the same language. We want to just repeat the same thing. And so get all of our practitioners trained. And what that did, well, one, we researched the childhood program for 10 years, or it took 10 years to be from the beginning to then we put an end date, and then they needed to complete. So 4 years there. And so that was all published in 2018. And through that process, we just learned so much about, again, application of a public health program. Like, actually, a lot of people, even though they bought the kit, they didn't do it. And so we're, you know, the failures in that research showed us, okay, what do we need to do better in the program? And also the organization was built in with the theme of service and benevolence, like what is going on with the people. And certainly, like you said, that childhood infectious disease, maybe that was before the recording, but childhood infectious disease is an opportunity for a child's immune system to develop past or through a developmental stage and or to clear miasmatic inheritance. And that struggle of the fever, that conflict, this like, I need to just keep breathing, like this is hurting me, but what's going on? And the immune system, like our immune systems know how to do this work if they're healthy, right? And when you get out the other side, there you're better. And certainly at that time, it was, so by the time I put it together, there's 2009, then there was enough people that had an appetite. We don't want to vaccinate. We don't know about homeopathy. They didn't even say that, but they were like, I wonder if there's an alternative to vaccines, because I don't want to do that. And that clearly was our foundation to start with. And we had just like finished that research, all published, everything. And it's just like, I was going to take a 2-year sabbatical. I went to India in January of 2020 and did a 10-day silent meditation. I'm like, okay, God, you know, I'm resetting, like taking a breath. And what's my next job? You know? And I got out of the Vipassana. So I had, there was also a homeoprophylaxis conference right before the Vipassana. And I came out, it was January 31st. And you know, the world had, you know, the 28th was the global announcement. And I got my phone back. Of course, we're in silence, right? And they take all the phones. You don't get that. You can't talk for 10 days. And got my phone back, and we have a WhatsApp group for all of our practitioners, and there was like 160 texts on there. So I came back. We had been sort of, well, we should do a flu study. You know, this will really prove homeoprophylaxis. We can do a seasonal influenza. And within 2 weeks, we had already sort of had the skeleton set up, but within 2 weeks, we had our coronavirus set up. So we launched that, and we already had our membership at that time of families. It was about 1,500 people. And so we just sent a newsletter. We've got, you want to do home and prophylaxis for coronavirus? And very quickly, we registered over 1,100 people in the program. And that gave me 2.5 more years of work to do. But that sort of set the stage for really beginning to dissect what this is about and where it comes from.
Wow. I always love stories, and I love listening to stories, to people's stories of how they got to where they were. And it's just so interesting, like right from the start, from your son, you know, that screaming after the vaccine, which as a homeopath, we hear in our clinics on a daily basis, and then having your daughter and then going to Cuba. And it's just so incredible. And then, I mean, you can't make this up. You having that retreat just before. I can just imagine opening up your phone and seeing all those messages and going, what?
And the truth of it is that when, after all was said and done and the last, all the papers submitted and published, I was like, there's nobody else in the world that could have done what we did. Mm. Like how we had set it up and how the infrastructure that we had, and we had, you know, we continued to give the NoZoTe after the research part, and we probably gave it to over 15,000 people through our network. And I believe it helped. I believed it helped humanity, whether or not people had access to the NoZoTe or not. But our work, you know, one of the things in India, right? I was in Pushkar, and the stupa, is that the right word? No, can't remember the word, but they have these chamber, meditation chamber for the Vipassana, and they have these bells that make this noise. The wind blows on them. And one of the girls that was there, she had come from Bhutan, and she had videos of the monks chanting. And I thought to myself, if it wasn't for, I don't know how many millions of people in India, I mean, millions do pray every day, and the monks chanting and all that. If it wasn't for them on the planet, and the hell that we went through from the tyrannical governments enforcing this strange madman's invention on us. And if it wasn't for those monks, like, I don't believe, or they like held the balance for us, you know, because part of the, I don't know, do you know Vipassana is the meditation? So it's the teachings of the Buddha, and it's sitting within, sitting in silence, and just breathing, and equanimity, no desire, aversion, like staying in yourself. And the last day of the Vipassana, and then as you do more, like I've done three so far, after three, then you can be a server. And Anapana is the last day. And that's where, I mean, basically, compassion for self is the only way to heal. And those are the Buddha's teachings. And that ultimately is what we as homeopaths are doing when we see our patients, is we're holding the space, listening to them, and having compassion. And the remedies hold them in compassion too, right? They see them for what they are. So the last day is the Anapana, which is having compassion for humanity. And so these monks sitting in, their service is to feel the pain and hold the space for the pain and have that noise and their prayer bells and the things like that.
Can I ask you about the NoZoTe itself? So how, I mean, you got back to the States, and then what was the practicality of how did you obtain the NoZoTe, and did you prove it first, or did you just give it straight away to your community?
Yep. We kind of just dove right in. I also had the opportunity. I was scheduled to go to see the Central Council for Research in Homeopathy in Delhi. So after the conference, I made the arrangement. Then I did the Vipassana, and then I was coming back to Delhi. And so I got to see what they're doing. The one NoZoTe at that time that they had researched was dengue. So I learned a little bit about that and asked about, you know, saw how they went through their research, and the whole world was on fire and so much fear came. Fortunately, we have a pharmacy in the U.S. that's a private membership pharmacy, and they were very proactive and have procured, it was 13 different, you know, nasal and lung discharge, coughing discharges, gone for independent testing, and they had the nodule by the end of January. So pretty quick they did. So we launched into the research. We set our first potency at the 1M. And the only reason we did that is, one, you're seeing on Facebook, like, the people falling over dead and dead people laying on the streets in China. I mean, really, I don't know if that really happened, right? Or if that was... So when a few people... Well, one of the things that they said about the dengue was that, you know, if you've had dengue before, that the second time you get it, you can go into the hemorrhagic. And so the first thing they did with the nozzle, they tested on these little fish. And they saw the cells in the fish were starting to bleed in the low potencies. And it was only above the 200 that there was no bleeding. And I don't know, I could have swore I saw some video of somebody starting to have hemorrhages or, you know, whatever it was. And so I said, okay, we're going to go with the 1M potency just to, you know, take it out of the water. And what I understand was that, going back to collective susceptibility, right? How are humans living on this planet? And this disease, I mean, the first thing I did when I got my phone before I left the Vipassana Center was to look at the U.S. Patent Office, and I found the coronavirus in the Patent Office.
What?
Yes. This didn't become public knowledge until 2022. But I'm like, it's in, because I went to Turkey a number of years back when Ebola was happening. And I was on a circuit. I had gone to Belgium. I had gone to Sweden. And then I had two conferences in Turkey and then went to Lebanon. And this was at the same time that the Syrian war had broke out and Ebola was just wrapping up in Africa. And of course, there's the hemorrhages that were happening there. And I looked at, you know, disease starts in the center and radiates out. And Ebola happened like seven different places that are geographically, tribally, and nationally separated. Like, you cannot, but they started simultaneously in these places. And the only thing they all had in common was they're right next to U.S. Army bases.
Wow.
So I've been following this, that right? And watching this. By 2016, I was like, you know, steam coming out of my head. Like, what is going on this planet? Like, how can we get out of this? But you asked a question and I just want to go back there because I lost the track. So we started with the 1M. Okay. So here it is, the collective susceptibility. I started seeing also how sick they were, how sick humanity was, and how they still loved their vaccines. And I just couldn't understand it. And, but more than that, how, well, in 2019, I published my book on glyphosate toxicity, and that was its own like rabbit hole of a road of realizing that our entire food system was completely poisoned and that our government passed the laws that allowed that to happen. And no longer, I mean, I already gave up thinking, you know, 9/11 happened, that our government is benevolent in any way whatsoever. And this idea of us going and imposing democracy around the world, it was all undercover manipulations. And the whole Iranian war was about bombing their seed bank and making them dependent on GMO crops. That's one thing that I learned from the glyphosate thing. Kim Aaliyah did research on the background of that. So susceptibility, how did we get? So if you give a low potency, at least this is in my mind of how home prophylaxis is working. At the beginning, there's a first few cases. But, you know, when you have, you're moving into like an individual, you're moving into an infectious disease thing, there's a chill. And you do not know how much vitality you need, how much fever you need to get to manage this infectious agent coming, right? And also, more than that, like, we know that all those with comorbidities had the worst time with COVID. And so, I mean, this is kind of reverse thinking with the potency, but at the beginning of the disease, the low potency was too crude. Like, there wasn't enough wisdom in it. So 1M is like, wow, we're just going to open the door up like another notch. So that's what we did. And the 1M, and then a few months later or 2 months later, we said, okay, let's actually go with a 10M. And eventually our protocol became a 1M single, 1M triple, followed by the 10M triple. And much like Golden's, dosing pattern and the childhood homeoprophylaxis pattern. And so you asked, was it approving? It was not approving. Like, it was designed, the research was designed to get as many people in as possible. We took active cases, those who had already long haul, like many had been sick from November through January, leading up, they didn't know what the disease was. And we also, as a organization, we were following, and this is why we wanted to do an influenza study, is like, this is the weirdest flu going around. Like, everybody has, it wasn't following a normal progression through an acute infectious disease. Like, the cough would come first and then the fever, and then they'd have vomiting and diarrhea. And that is like, that's not what, usually you don't have a cough and vomiting and diarrhea. Like, those two are not, you either have a gastrointestinal flu or an upper respiratory flu, right? Something like that. And then fever is usually what comes first. Or if it's vomiting and diarrhea, then that comes first, then fever. But in this situation, it was all skewy. So we took in the cases that had active disease and the ones exposed, and we set up a 2-week follow-up so that we could track their symptoms. So what happened after you took the Nozode? And the symptoms coming showed us, well, two things. One is, or three things. So the collective group of symptoms of the active cases we used to measure whether or not people got sick, because that gave us a symptom picture, right, upon which to prescribe. Then the proving symptoms were, somebody would just have like flushes of heat or a sudden headache or body aches, but it wasn't like a symptoms that would come and go. But collectively, you could put it together, 10 people had these symptoms. Oh, but that looked like the active case, right? And so we used that to determine, did people get sick after the Nozode, right? And so there's 3-month follow-up, nobody, despite 100% definite exposure to family members that had been sick, did not get sick with the Nozode. So we were testing efficacy, we were testing safety. We had all age groups from pregnant women to 90-year-olds. And then the proving was the collation of all of those symptoms that came forward. Not only then, because those active symptoms, they were cured after the first dose or after the triple dose, the person got better and they had been sick for 3 months before, right? So those were cured symptoms, and that's part of the clinical part that's also in the repertorization like that. Yeah.
That's very cool. And now that we're a few years on, when people come to see you now with Never Well since COVID, what sort of potencies are you going in at? Because I've had a few of those in my clinic, and it'd be interesting to hear how you approach those cases. If it's a Never Well since, I always use the Nozode. But have you got a particular potency that you go in on, or a particular protocol?
Yes. Early on in my homeopathic practice, I realized that the Never Well since always comes from a basis of the immune system or miasmatic history, and they need an immune boost to activate the immune system to be able to focus that. So usually what happens is they start an immune process and then their kind of gas runs out, which is their Jing or their vital force or their just baseline, is it psoric? Mostly it's carcinosin that's needed. Early on in my practice, I noticed when I gave carcinosin, the one that I had came from India, and people would get a fever. I'm like, that's interesting. And then they would feel better after. And so anytime anybody came with a Never Well since influenza, pneumonia, mono, and certainly COVID, I started with carcinosin, and then the very next day give the Nozode. And using the 1M, like the first weekend, do it carcinosin, the 1M, then during the week, whatever remedy you think is the most supportive remedy, like bryonia or arsenicum or camphor or something. And then the next weekend, do a triple dose of carcinosin and triple dose of the Nozode. And then depending on what it is, I'll repeat the following. Our pharmacy also has a spike protein, isolated spike protein, because one of the things that we learned through the categorization of symptoms, there was a group of symptoms that were strange, rare, and peculiar symptoms. And we were like, how do these symptoms fit in with the overall picture? And there's one video that we have on our website, freeandhealthychildren.org. And all of our research is there. So people can look at it, the published articles. We also, there's many videos looking at the numbers and then the themes, the remedy, and so on like that. And we determined, so we started looking at those symptoms. This was in about April or May of 2021. So one of the symptoms was males with more erections. This is a strange symptom to have during an immunological event, right? And excessive urination, that's also an unusual symptom, right? And there's a whole list of them that it just didn't fit in with what we would look at as an immunological profile. And then we realized this is the angiotensin system. And then all of a sudden we understood the aspect that the spike protein joins onto the angiotensin receptors. And then in the lung, there's other receptors that pull the virus within the cell where the cell replicates, but part of its replication, it gets the genetics of the cell to downregulate the converting enzyme, angiotensin converting enzyme, so that the spike protein remains active on the cells, right? And so there's the continued coughing. So that angiotensin, that needs to be released. It's no longer like a post immunological thing, it's an angiotensin thing. So giving the spike protein in a similar dosing pattern releases that. Nice. And that you can also have the headaches and other things. There's neuralgic pains and it goes into the pituitary. It goes into, and certainly that's what was being affected from the vaccine fallout of the spike protein was getting transferred from one to another. And we know that the spike protein through all the research is, you know, goes into the ovaries and testes. And so then there's hormonal dysregulation and affects the pituitary and things like that. So that's the next line, depending on how the symptoms show up in the person.
And I think something else that didn't help the poor pituitary is the bloody radiation guns that they were having on everyone's, you know, third eye, like testing them how many times a day.
When they did that, I'm like, you can do it on my wrist.
Yeah.
Or you can do it here. You're pointing a gun at my head and I don't like it.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So I have actually told this story on the podcast before, but I had something really interesting happen. So I have never had a cold sore or I think it's also called a fever blister, but a cold sore in my life. Mm-hmm. None of my parents, none of my siblings, not my husband, nobody in my immediate family has ever had cold sores. It's just not something I grew up with. I've worked with people mm-hmm. who had it and they've, you know, said how terrible it is and everything else. And I always felt so sorry for these people and so much pain with their cold sores. So probably about August 2021. So we had the vaccine rollout, I think about June 2021-ish, around there. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we had somebody that stayed over who had just had their vaccine, but they didn't tell us. And we did say to them, if you're coming and you're getting the vaccine, just please stay away for a period of time. But they didn't. And they didn't tell us till the next day that they had the vaccine just the day before. But the day they arrived that night, my son was vomiting the entire night. And he is one of the healthy, both my children are two of the healthiest kids you'll ever meet. So for them to have this random vomiting bug out of nowhere, it was strange in itself. But I woke up the next morning with this massive cold sore on my lip. And I thought it was a bunch of pimples. I had no idea what it was initially, out of nowhere. And then it's been a recurring thing since then. And then that next day they said to us, they just had their shots the day before. So I was livid. And mm-hmm. it's been really interesting how even those of us who didn't have the vaccine have had so many interesting fallout, you know, from the people around us. And the other thing is that in January 2022, I ended up in hospital with a ruptured appendix. And I'm completely the wrong age group for that. And while I was in hospital, I Googled and it did say there was actually studies that show that there was an increased risk of ruptured appendix after you've had the COVID vaccine. Now, I didn't have it, but I do believe that anybody who has not had the vaccine have had many of the same sort of side effects because of the spike proteins and everything else. So there's definitely been some interesting things.
Well, the thing with the herpes is a retrovirus. So the reason carcinosin is so useful, one of the other genetic modification things that the virus does is it suppresses the immune system. And when the immune system is suppressed, there's a what are called the adenosine receptor sites. So adenosine regulates the immune system to turn on the immune system or to turn it off. And certainly Fauci and the likes figured that out in the 80s, and that's with AIDS, they figured out how to turn off the immune system. Well, the number one remedy that turns the immune system back on is carcinosin. It somehow releases the adenosine from those receptor sites, and that's why we're seeing the fevers. So all retroviruses were getting activated. So one of the things that our group was watching, and we've seen it over as the actual virus is disintegrating into its parts, right? And there's different waves, and certainly, you know, they're releasing a new vaccine. I don't know how many people are willing to jab themselves up with that these days.
You'll be surprised.
I know. And certainly the vaccine has its fallout, right? So there's been different waves that we've seen. And so it seems like, and we're all around the nation, and some we have in Europe as well. It's like all of a sudden we're having these massive strep cases. Well, part of the genes of COVID is they're upregulating strep. Then we're seeing like there was a 2 or 3 month period where it was all worms and ringworm and parasites. And we're like, this is bizarre. I mean, it did come up in the proving that ringworm symptoms came up and candida overgrowth that came up, but retrovirus, there was a 2 month period where it was all about herpes and mono, like every, you know, people were, I have a case and I have a case of this. And so those two, they're both in the herpes virus family, right? And shingles also is coming up. And
there was a lot of shingles over here as well. So much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it all has to do with that suppression or the release of that. So carcinosin is there, and then the spike protein is needed to resolve that and get that. So when the immune system is up and working, then those retroviruses are just tucked into the DNA and they don't come out like that. I was in Croatia in, you know, as we're studying this, and I'm walking around, I'm in Zagreb, and you know, usually when I'm traveling, this is the time that I get to daydream and like the most, amazing things come to me. I'm thinking about all these ringworm cases and parasite cases and worms. And then I'm thinking about the nosode. It's like, okay, in China, these people that we took a nosode of their snot and what they're discharging, you know, like... They also have like all that 5G just turned on, and every single one of they also have parasites and candida and every kind of thing. I mean, there was sensitivity to EMFs that came up as a symptom. And the thing is that really the state of health of humanity is really bad. And we're so infected with so many different things, and our immune systems haven't been sorting them out. And but I say, coronavirus nosode keeps on giving, and the coronavirus keeps on giving because what we have to do is a serious rectification of how we choose to live on this planet and how we choose to live with ourselves and how we choose to live with creation. And as humans, we're these incredibly complex, spiritual, vital organisms that have the capacity for magic in health. And the degradation of human health, from the food poisoning and to the political systems, to there's no benevolence in any government anywhere. There's other ways that we can live here. And that, you know, I had to leave the country 2021. I was just in the, after the proving was done and what we saw and the darkness of it, I bought some land in Costa Rica and I lived in a tent in the jungle there, you know, for 2 months. And I was like, and it rained and I cried and it rained and I cried. I really had not worked except for that Vipassana for 12 years. I mean, I had just kept working. And I hadn't had enough time to catch up with myself. And I just felt like I was jumping ship like the rats do before the boat goes down. Like I knew that something serious was happening and I was deciding to jump over into a new world and a new way of living. And so I thought, you know, about giving up homeopathy. And at that point in time, you know, the vaccine rollout had started in the fall of 2021 and everybody's clamoring to get it. And then everybody was sick for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I'm just like, go away. I don't even want to help you anymore. Like, stop, you know, try some silence and just go, what is going on? What in humanity? But, and I just saw too, like the infertility rates and, you know, there's sexual conversion things happening and the biome, everybody's biome was so distorted. And still, I hadn't got to the next set of work yet. I had to come to a deep place in compassion for myself and even for humanity, because I had really lost it for humanity by that time. And then when I said, okay, well, I had some revelation, and then I was like, okay, I am going back and I'm going to be a homeopath. So how am I going to do that? And what am I going to do? And within about 24 hours, 7 new homeoprophylaxis programs dropped in my head about how we can start working with fertility, how we can start working with moms and pregnancies, how to clear miasmatic history, to clear out sexually transmitted diseases, to fix up the biome, like a homeoprophylaxis program that has every different biome one because antibiotics have destroyed us, you know, and how to make families inclusive, like not tell the grandparents to go away if you're not vaccinated, like grandparents need to come and see the babies so their immune system stays strong, because our immune systems are collective phenomena. They do not work in isolation. They collapse in isolation. And these are the things that we learn with COVID, and certainly it keeps giving. So this is what the next set of work is about. Free and Healthy Children International, we are building a website. It's taken a lot longer than we thought, but we are going to embark on research in all of these programs, and we're rolling. It's a slow rollout. We are going to be having symposiums and talking much more about what this means to clear that miasmatic history, to correct the immunity, to, you know, if humans, it was like I call a Noah's Ark moment. Like if humans are choosing to live here, we have to choose to live differently. And homeopathy has some tools to fix this up.
We have some kick-ass tools.
Yeah.
Kate, is there a particular spiritual lesson that you felt collectively there is to learn out of the COVID nozode, but also the disease itself, or for you personally or collectively, is there, what's some of the main messages that you've received?
Well, one of the things that, like, of the 1,100 people who entered the research, you know, 300 of them were in an abject state of fear, terror. The fear was overwhelming. And I thought a lot about that fear. And in the summer of 2021, because we have our practitioners to different places, we all put the COVID nozode in a body of water. So Lake Superior, Pacific Ocean, Atlantic Ocean, there's whatever the ocean is off of Australia, I don't know, in the Atlantic on the East Coast to Mississippi River, just as an offering. And I did mine on California coast. And I watched the petals fall into the water, and like the water just for a moment, and then it just kept on being the ocean. And the California coast is a pretty rugged coast. But after I was walking along, and I wanted to go out on this rock, and so it's high cliffs, it's 50 to 100 feet down to the ocean. And I walked down, and there was this just a little bit, and there was a homeless man there, and he was just a random person. And you know, I didn't really want to talk to him because I'm disturbed by homeless people, but he's like, there's a lot more seagulls this year. And so that started this whole conversation about, and this is in Northern California where the redwoods are. So I had done a proving of redwood before. And that year I knew California had been in the drought. The redwood were really not doing well. They were dying. And so we talked about redwood summer, you know, anyways. But then I realized, he's like, yeah, since Fukushima, you know, this the seaweeds growing back, the fishes, there's fishermen out here. And I stood there, and it's directly across from Japan. And I stood there and something happened. A big wave came over me. And I thought, World War II also affected the California coast. And when I left there, I had been put into a completely ballistic state, particularly also leaving because the forest was dead, the grapevines were dead, California was dead. They were giving $15 million away to get your COVID vaccine. The drought, the water reservoirs were completely dried up. And everybody's talking about they basically have been spraying California with every kind of aerosol spray so that everything just went up in flames. And by the time I got on the plane and put my mask on, I mean, I was literally going to explode, right? And then I came home and said, I really need help. Like, what? Help me here. And so I was just twiddling through Facebook and I came across a video that another homeopath put together, and it was plutonium. It was about the benefits of radiation, right? But homeopathic remedies, the radioactive homeopathic remedies, because literally I was going to explode. And I was like, okay, I need the plutonium nitricum. And I took that remedy. And then I saw the 100 years of history that was in the design of COVID, of what humans have been doing since World War II. And that it started with that. And the state of fear that that bomb, the shock waves around the planet. So, you know, COVID isn't that, but COVID is a door to that. And through the repertorization, there's of the, you know, over 800 symptoms of COVID, 174 of them, plutonium nitricum is in that rubric as well. And in the mind symptoms as well. And so it certainly is like, you know, radiation has the capacity to alter genes. What were they doing making that virus? It's all genetic engineering and genetic alterations. And even the, you know, there's news coming out now that the vaccines are contaminated with DNA and they are changing the genetics of humanity. And these things I knew going while I was in Costa Rica as well. I mean, we knew it from just sitting with our heads and collating these symptoms and are looking out in the world and people are still getting their vaccines. So we knew that was all there. And then with these new homeoprophylaxis programs, like sifalinum helps to correct the genetics. And so using sifalinum is a great remedy. Like, it brought on all this huge cerebral development. I still think that we're just sort of emerging. We do not know yet the flower that COVID is going to blossom, but there is something more to come. Yeah.
Definitely. Now, for our listeners, they can also, you also have homeopathic immunization or homeoprophylaxis online courses that people can do worldwide, and you have a whole pile of books available as well. Where can people find the links to your books and your courses and find out more about the work that you do and also for the Free and Healthy Children Project?
So there's that site sort of articulates most things. So we train practitioners to join our organization because we are a public health platform, if you could say. And so we want to train them, and then we need economics. And so there we have a built-in system of where we gain money through families registering, and practitioners do their own work like that. So 100% of my time is teaching through Free and Healthy Children International. And then there's Whole Health Now has a glyphosate course, a glyphosate toxicity. So that's a whole other avenue to go down. And I have acute care course, but that's also through Free and Healthy Children, and infectious disease too, and also vaccine detox. There, it's all on there. And then there is, under the events tab, there is a whole list of podcasts, and all of my books are linked there too. So depending on, people can listen, and there's different talks, you know, on each book.
I see you did a whole series. It was, I think, like 15 episodes on one
particular podcast. Yeah, exactly.
The whole series of, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And the books are on Amazon too. So, and interestingly, if you put in my name in the search bar, there's another Kate Birch.
I found that out when I was Googling you.
who wrote a book on a plague coming to destroy the planet. I found out about her a long time ago, but some 10 years later, she found out and she said, I can't believe it's you. You're a homeopath. No, like, don't you know there's plagues coming to this planet? Like, it's just so hilarious. Like, who wrote that book? You know, who gave her that name?
Is there a final message that you want to leave our listeners with? I mean, it's not all doom and gloom, right? Like, is there like a final uplifting message that you want to leave them with so we don't all just go and sit in a corner and cry about all this corruption?
Well, sometimes that crying is very important.
Crying is important.
It is important because we need to break down. We need to
feel the feels, right? Like, you need to, it's important to feel the feels. Like,
yeah, you do. And you need the compassion. More importantly, you need to know yourself behind your suffering. It means, who are you behind the suffering? Mm. And that opens a door into a whole other, like, we're in these physical bodies. We're looking out these eyes, but who's that looking out? And at least through all of my work and how I've managed to maintain sanity is to continue to practice the Vipassana and just breathe, which is so interesting because I can't breathe was the slogan for COVID. And of course, the George Floyd riot started here in Minneapolis. And one of the things that he said is he can't breathe in him, and it just set up. So breathing, that's the only thing you can do in the Vipassana is breathing. And that's, we just need to breathe and clean up our air and stop poisoning ourselves.
And humans have such an amazing capacity to heal. I saw a beautiful little reel this morning, and it said that the people with the biggest health complaints often have the largest capacity to heal, because they know, and the biggest appreciation and capacity to experience joy, because when you've gone through something that deep, it also then gives you, you know, it's the yin and the yang, then gives you that capacity to experience the ecstatic joy that comes with that health. Mm-hmm. So just realizing, keep breathing, and you are going to go out the other end. And our bodies are amazing. It always wants to heal. And I've just this week with a client of mine with very severe autism, and we're doing vaccine detoxing. Actually, interestingly, we've done the Pfizer detox. He's 15 and he had the vaccine last year. And just after he had the 30C of the vaccine, his whole body broke out in angiomas. And I just think it's those spike proteins, like, just pushing out through the skin.
In the infectious disease model, it's like one disease, one disease, one disease, you know, working like that. And vaccine-free was certainly written like that. But COVID is 100 different diseases. They've put together the genetics. And so based on what your underlying health is, those individuals that have comorbidities through the roof and every kind of, you know, it's not going to, you can't make it through COVID. So as the COVID is breaking down, it's pulling out these different things. It's like, oh, we need to address this. We need to address this. And even though, I mean, we could potentially be grateful for them to be mad scientists to come up with this concoction to terrorize the planet and capitalize on the whole thing. But the other side of it is that it's given us an opportunity to say, what is this neglected disease that I haven't paid attention to, and so on and so forth?
That's definitely the way I see it. And definitely, you know, people that I've known for a very long time that are very pro-vaccination and just completely have just no clue what's going on have woken up. So I've just seen so many positives that's come out of all of this. And I don't know that we could have gotten people there if we didn't put them through hell. Like, I really... as humans are a comfortable bunch, and we don't like to change until we get forced to. So I don't know. There's been a lot of good that's come out of all of this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have to call in a new world.
Thank you so much for your time, Kate. I really appreciate speaking with you. And I hope more practitioners get in touch with you. And if they're not familiar with homeoprophylaxis, go and do your courses so they can educate themselves on these things. Yeah. When I actually learned about it, I was so, you know, annoyed that we never got taught more about it at college. It's really essential that
there's a censorship that's going on in the practice of homeopathy in the schools of homeopathy.
Yeah, it's very strange. But there's so many homeopaths that are so against homeoprophylaxis. And that was, you know, that's one of those things. Sorry, this is kind of a whole other conversation itself starting. But I was really against it as well, only because I had never been really given the full picture of it. And it wasn't until I found Isaac Golden's work that I was like, oh, wow, this stuff's amazing. And I, you know, I used to be very pro-vaccination before I actually studied to be a homeopath, because I had just never been told that there was a different way. And this is like, you know, 2009. Just never told there was a different way. And the same with homeoprophylaxis. And I really hope those homeopaths that are listening to this that are still think, you know, it's something that you should only treat the symptoms, not prophylactically, all that. Go and open their minds, go and do your course, and go and actually educate themselves on what this is all about. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a huge fan of homeoprophylaxis, and I think it has incredible, mm-hmm. incredible benefits for the planet and for our health.
Let me say just two things on what you said there. One is the symptom picture. So what does the symptom picture look like of a child who needs measles? We don't know that.
You don't know until you give it to them.
We don't know it. Exactly. And if the theory is right, and it is right, that children need childhood infectious diseases to, you know, one of the things that measles does is it activates autonomy, activates the self-defense mechanism to live on this planet, and activates independence. And what do we have now is an entire generation of dependent children that, you know, and MMR vaccines. So when does dependence start? It's going to begin with weaning a little bit, 3-4 years old, 6 years old, the teeth, the change of life, you know, the change of teeth, that's where they first are going to claim their independence, but that's not happening. The children are. So do you recognize that picture? Not until you've understood homeoprophylaxis or really understood the infectious disease. And every infectious disease we have in our program, we're not preventing disease. We're actually activating an evolutionary process. And this is one of the second part is I went to that conference in Cuba thinking, homeopathy is the best, constitutional treatment is the best. Oh, if an infectious disease comes along, you treat it with homeopathy. And Golden gave some, you know, his numbers were that those children who took homeoprophylaxis alone were healthier than those who had done homeopathy. And I thought about that. I was like, that's really, how does that work? And then I thought, okay, he's giving nosodes. I understood chronic disease and miasms are like unresolved acute disease, you know. And so I thought, what's happening is he's liberating the miasms. By giving these childhood diseases, he's liberating the miasms. And so it's, you're curing. This is homeopathy. It's not anything else.
That was what was the aha moment for me in his PhD, was when he had the four groups of children, those had been conventionally vaccinated, those who had had nothing, those who just had constitutional homeopathic treatment, and those who had homeoprophylaxis, and that the ones who'd had the prophylaxis actually had better health outcomes than the ones who had just constitutional treatment. And I had such a beautiful, vivid case of this little boy who, you know, they did my homeoprophylaxis course that I had been teaching the last few years as well. And they gave him the Pitocin Nozode, and he developed this whooping cough type cough for about 24, 48 hours, and then it was gone. And he just had such a developmental leap after that. But then it turns out that the dad actually had whooping cough at 17, and it was a never well since case. And the thing is, you would never know that magically
passed out.
You didn't give that nosode. And in our family, my great granddad died of tuberculosis. Now, if it just so turns out that that's a miasmatic constitutional remedy for me and my children.
We're related.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is that if I didn't know that, I mean, how many people know the health history of their parents, their grandparents, their great grandparents, their great great grandparents? So you don't know if there's somebody in your family who had a disease and they have been never well since, or maybe died from that, and that had energetically, genetically been transferred down to you. I just think it's like a no-brainer. Just give those nosodes. If there's something to clear, if your vital force resonates, it's going to have that opportunity to clear it out. And if there's nothing there, it's not going to do anything. So I'm a huge advocate for homeoprophylaxis after being completely skeptical about it 10 years ago and thinking, oh, that's silly. So, skeptics make the best converts, right?
They do. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Have a wonderful day.
Okay. Bye-bye.